Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of the show is Life and Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are its traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get notebook, paper, and pen for later in the show. First, each week we look at some debt-related news and facts. If you are living in California, it's been estimated that 1,300 foreclosures occur there every business day. And more on foreclosures from New York Reuters. U.S. foreclosure activity in July rose 55% from a year earlier as a slump in once sizzling housing markets forced yet more borrowers to default on their mortgages, according to a monthly report. Foreclosure filings, default notices, auction sales, and bank repossessions rose 8% from June and 55% from July 2007 to 272,171, according to RealtyTrack, which records property in various stages of foreclosure. That means one in every 464 U.S. households received a foreclosure filing in July, the firm said. Bank repossessions, known as REOs, rose 184% year over year. Default notices were up 53%, and auction notices rose 11%. The sharp rise in REOs, combined with slow sales, has resulted in a bloated inventory of bank-owned properties for sale. RealtyTrack now has more than 750,000 properties in its active REO database, or about 17% of the inventory of existing homes for sale reported in June by the National Association of Realtors. Among the 230 metro areas tracked, Cape Coral, Fort Myers, Florida registered the highest foreclosure rate. One in every 64 households there received a foreclosure filing last month, more than seven times the national average. By state, Nevada led the country with its foreclosure rate in July, as one in every 106 households received a foreclosure filing. Foreclosure activity in Nevada rose 15% from the previous month and 97% from July 2007. REOs in Nevada jumped 384% from a year ago, default notices surged 59%, and auction notices rose 31%. In California, one in every 182 properties received a foreclosure filing. Florida was third, with one in every 186 properties, while Arizona's rate was one in every 195 properties. Other states with foreclosure rates among the top 10 were Ohio, Georgia, Michigan, Colorado, Utah, and Virginia. And as you said, California homes over the past 2 years are foreclosing at the rate of 1,300 houses every business day. Foreclosures are continuing to rise sharply. It is clear that far fewer homeowners are finding a way out of foreclosure. And from an editorial in the New York Times on foreclosures, a year into the financial crisis, the news is grim and there are signs of even worse troubles ahead. The mortgage bust continues and has begun to spread to loans for construction and commercial property, as well as credit cards and auto loans, which we've discussed before. There may soon be more bank failures and a spate of corporate bankruptcies. That means that unemployment will almost certainly rise. Employers have shed nearly 500,000 jobs this year. And those who will keep their jobs will have to cope with fewer hours, measlier raises, and evaporating bonuses. In an election year, sound policy making is almost always trumped by political posturing, making the situation even bleaker. A case in point is the new foreclosure prevention law. President Bush threatened for months to veto it before signing it into law in July. The law's main feature, allowing the government to guarantee hundreds of billions of dollars in new mortgages to troubled borrowers, won't take effect until October 1st. The law's other important feature, a contingency plan for a government bailout of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, the nation's biggest mortgage companies, was a last-minute, crisis-driven addition, the opposite of the ahead-of-the-curve action that is now needed. The country can't afford more delay and more posturing, but the crisis gets worse. Congress needs to take more steps before then. According to the editorial in the Times, lawmakers need to start crafting the next stimulus bill without repeating the mistakes of the last one. Composed mainly of tax rebates, as the White House wanted, the first stimulus was too broad to deliver a powerful punch. The next package has to focus on actions that are known to yield big economic benefits, bolster food stamps, which rapidly boost consumption, and aid to states and cities so they can continue to provide essential services. Lawmakers should also invest in infrastructure projects like repairing bridges and roads. If not, projects that are already underway may have to be canceled, creating more unemployment. Congress also needs to ensure that a $4 billion grant to states and cities to buy up vacant properties is quickly and efficiently distributed. The Department of Housing and Urban Development is developing the formula for allocating the money, and early indications suggest it is on top of the process. But the White House is contemptuous of the grant, calling it a gift to speculators when it is actually a lifeline for ailing communities, according to the Times. So this means that Congress will have to be especially vigilant. Congress also cannot wait to see if its anti-foreclosure measures work. It must begin to vet other ideas and be ready to move quickly if the crisis worsens. Most important, lawmakers should be ready to reform the bankruptcy law so that homeowners can have their mortgages modified under court protection. That is arguably the best way to prevent foreclosures, but it is also the policy most reviled by the mortgage industry. Lawmakers should let the industry know that if lenders are not willing to back the foreclosure prevention effort wholeheartedly, before the government can step in, the law requires that the balances be reduced. They will be seeing the homeowners in bankruptcy court. The work doesn't end there. The Bush administration and federal regulators need to develop a framework for resolving future financial failures before they occur. That is essential for rebuilding confidence in the system. Millions of Americans are already suffering, and we fear millions more will be hurt before this crisis ends. They cannot wait until after the election for help. And this was all according to an editorial in the New York Times. For those of you who are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. I am speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. So now let's get into some points that can help us to personally rebalance against these kinds of situations that are happening in the markets, in the economy. As an important credit at the onset of this show, remember that the thoughts, ideas, and examples used in this show are from or based on the work, theories, and books of Professor Elizabeth Warren from Harvard and her daughter Amelia Warren Tyagi. And I recommend their books, All Your Worth and The Two Income Trap, to all the listeners. We'll start with a recap of the new points from last week's show, and remember that these shows continue to build one on each other from week to week. You can also visit the archives of the shows at www.liptaklaw.com/life-and-debt, and it's liptaklaw.com/life-and-debt. Last week we emphasized the advantages of using cash because it's easy to tell how much you can spend, no need to keep complicated spending records, no surprises at the end of the month, no damaged credit records, no billing mistakes or overcharges, no late fees or over-the-limit charges, no interest charges, no risk of going into debt. Some merchants will give a discount if you use cash, and hopefully cash is accepted everywhere. And that really is in comparison or a contradistinction to using credit cards. But we also said, well, some people hate to carry cash. They feel that they can lose it or get mugged, something of that nature. And we're talking about using cash primarily for your wants, the things that you will get when you are just traveling about and not a pre-planned thing necessarily. When you actually look at the amount of money you'd be carrying, it's really not that much, because your wants component of the formula, even if you're making $30,000, your wants or fund budget would only be roughly about $400 a month, which means about $100 in your pocket a week. And that means that you'd be carrying $100, but if you only took $50 and left $50 at home, you're pretty safe. And the point is just you're using cash, you are making sure that you're not getting sucked into the credit card reality and losing tremendous amounts of extra money because of that. And also for the things that aren't in your wants category, for the things in your must-have category, those things you can pay for by check. And another point, we also suggested that you should keep a little bit of your cash money aside for emergencies, for things that pop up that aren't really big emergencies, but little emergencies. You have something broke, a battery for your watch, you needed to get a new battery, or you forgot a present for somebody, or you needed to give your kids some money that wasn't necessarily in your budget. Somebody popped into your house by surprise and you needed to get some extra food. Those are the kind of things that you would use this wants money for, and having that cash around would be very useful. And we also mentioned having a little internal budgeting, tucking away some of your wants money to save it up for a bigger wants item, like a trip or a new item, a new sofa or television. That's kind of your piggy bank concept, and you will save that up, not in your savings account, but this is just extra wants category items for that appliance or that special meal that you're going to get that's quite expensive, that kind of thing. And of course, remember that before we had credit cards back in the day, people were using cash and it was not a crisis. And in fact, the economy and the people's general savings was in a much healthier posture. So this is not an impossible task to use cash. And of course, in terms of wants cash, there are also things that you will use checks for instead of cash when you have memberships or cell phones, things that are by definition in the wants category, not the must-have categories, recreational items like that. So of course you can use cash for those, but you can also use checks, and they need to be accounted for too. So you have to make sure that that's all coming out of your wants money, not your must-have money. The other thing we spoke about last week was emotional spending, and this is a very typical thing for people, because money is a funny thing. You earn it, you pay for your must-haves, and you pay toward your future, and then the rest should be fun, in theory. And yet, for many people, we feel guilty, and we have all kinds of emotional issues regarding money, and the wants category becomes especially interesting here when we're talking about emotional spending. We see that we use much of our wants money for trying to make up for maybe a feeling of guilt, impressing others, spending money to fight off feelings of sadness or anger or loneliness or disappointment. So these really aren't in any fun category, because this kind of money expenditure is deeply laden with symbolism and emotion. And of course, there are no magicians who can wave the magic wand that make all of your emotional baggage disappear. But if you have a problem with emotional spending, then it actually could be costing you both money and, perhaps more importantly, happiness. So in this wands category, it's really time to ask yourself whether you want to get rid of these demons lurking in your spending psychology or just let them be. And we gave a test on emotional spending, trying to determine if we are an emotional spender. And it was a true and false test, which we will review again and see if any of these are true or false for you. Question one, I spend money when I get depressed or lonely. When people see me with nice things, they think more highly of me. That's true and false. I spend money to relax and relieve stress. I worry that people may not respect me as much if I don't have nice things. I often pick up the check when I am out with someone so I look successful or generous. It takes a lot of money to look good. I spend a lot to make my friends and loved ones happy. It takes a lot of money to attract a date. Sometimes I'm afraid to say no to spending money on someone I care about. I am sometimes ashamed or embarrassed by how much money I spend. My loved ones expect me to spend a lot of money for gifts at holidays. Sometimes I spend money on things I don't really want because it is expected of me. And as I said, all those are true or false. And if you marked true for two or more statements, then you have a challenge with emotional spending, and it's really time to look at that carefully. Because emotions and money are very deeply intertwined for you, and sorting through it can be a difficult task, but it would be good that you do, and you'll feel better in the long run once you develop the habit of separating the feelings from your decisions about how to spend your money. Whatever ails your heart, of course, will not be fixed with money. If you are feeling unhappy, lonely, or insecure, those feelings will linger no matter how much money you spend. So spending will change your feeling about your spouse, your parents, your children, or yourself. It just won't make anyone love or respect you anymore. So that's an important principle. And difficulties with money will feed your emotional problems, which will only add more stress to your life. And of course, the origin of these problems is somewhere inside of you, and your out-of-control spending will make the emotional problems worse. So you have to get control by separating the two. And this is hard to figure out. And the perfect answer is to solve the emotional problem head-on and to keep money out of the picture. And now we will look at a few practical steps to get strong emotions out of the middle of your spending. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life in Debt, your debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. So directly dealing with the emotional spending, the first point is identify where you're vulnerable. Take a look at the answers, true and false answers to the test that we just had, and do you see a pattern? Is there a particular type of experience that triggers your emotional spending? Maybe you spend when you feel certain emotions, or maybe you spend when you're around certain people. Identifying the exact moment when you are most vulnerable can help you take steps to protect yourself and to, of course, not spend that money and to separate out the emotion from the expenditure or the decision to make that expenditure. The second point is to protect yourself from temptation. If you have a problem with emotional spending, then one very important thing is, frankly, just to throw out your credit cards. Now, of course, that may sound a little extreme, but being a bankruptcy attorney and seeing a lot of people get in trouble with credit cards, we know how challenging those little pieces of plastic can be. You can actually take them and put them to rest by cutting them up immediately. And, of course, this may be a little bit anxiety-provoking, but it can help you to remove your crutch on emotional spending. Cutting up the credit cards could be the most important step in your financial health. and the emotional well-being that goes with that. Using credit cards for ordinary fun purchases is a bad idea for everyone. So using credit cards for the swans category is absolutely a wrong concept. It's just really dangerous, and it is a constant source of temptation. And it is there whenever you really feel that weakness or that moment of neediness. And so just as if you were an alcoholic and there was booze around, or if you were a smoker and there's cigarettes around, or if you are having challenges with your weight and there's all of this junk food around, then of course you're going to see that stimulus and it's going to create some immediate desire to use the thing. Credit cards are the same way, so you should just get rid of them, and that will help you to get rid of the emotion eventually, and it will certainly keep you within your budget. And point three, another important point, is if you're having problems with emotional spending, get a little help. When you want to make really lifetime changes, important big changes, it's often important to get a support circle to help you, to nurture you, and to reaffirm those changes. So think about this emotional spending, think about the people close to you, and think, is there someone you can talk to about your emotional spending? And the talk is good. Bringing it to the surface is good. Describing your struggles can help you put them in perspective. And of course, by speaking with somebody who is intelligent and caring and nurturant, that person can give you some more ideas on how to help solve the problem. And this is a very important and necessary step in getting rid of emotional spending. And in the final analysis, it's important to recognize that the bottom line is always the same regardless of what kind of thing is triggering your emotional spending. If you are spending emotionally, you are trying to fix something that money really can never fix. It's not about the money, it's about something else that really is unrelated to money. So you can go ahead and you can feel the feelings that you have, whether it's anger or guilt or beauty or happiness, whatever you need to feel. But the important principle and goal is to keep the money out of it. Separate your spending of money from the feelings that are triggering the need to spend it in a certain way. And that separation will help you step more strongly to a road of success and fulfillment in your life when it comes to money. Taking those emotions out of the situation of spending may seem complicated at first, but if you use these steps, you will find that when you take the emotions out of the formula, then the rational need to spend money for a specific thing becomes very clear, and you can get into the field of wants with some success without all of this emotion attached to it. Another issue you have to deal with is if you are a couple and you have a fund of wants money and you have to share it. And this is an important category. How do you solve divvying up the money? And the concept is simple. It's fun money for you and fun money for your partner. And really, once it is divvied up, there should be no questions asked. And that's really an important principle. No asking where the money was spent, no offering advice on how it should be spent, no justifying why you got a good deal, and just don't ask and don't tell. Policy is an important thing with your wants money. There really should be no analysis here. It doesn't matter if you're trying to save every penny to buy a new house, for example, and your partner doesn't want to do that with the wants money. They want to blow the want money on something which they really are desiring, and you find it totally ridiculous and dumb beyond belief. But remember that this is a budget amount for pleasure, really, and it's purely pleasure. The critical point here is that everyone needs fun money, period. No matter how tight the budget, there must be cash for both of you to spend on whatever each of you want with no questions asked. It's really like personal space. There's no quarreling over these silly little expenditures. No negotiating on every purchase. No second-guessing each other. And that's just the bottom line. Everybody needs to have some personal space. Everybody needs to have some spending money, and it should not be questioned. The next issue, though, would be how do you divvy it up? And this is really dependent upon your relationship. Should it be 50-50? That's a possibility, and it works for a lot of people. But if one person is, for example, taking care of kids more and doing things that will include family members more so, then maybe they should get some more money in terms of the wants money, because they have to come up with these little emergencies and whatnot, and they have to cover those. But that's really something that you have to decide for yourself. And the point here is to find a process for dividing the fund money that feels fair to each of you, and then keep that process working for each of you no matter what. You do get some money every week or every month, how you get paid, and every payday you'll get a little cash to spend however you want. So the bottom line and the end point really is that you have to make room for fun. The wants money is there for that, and your life has to be a creative, progressing life, and the picture that you are creating out of it is really yours to create and yours to enjoy. And we want you to stop thinking so much about money and to really enjoy life, doing what we've done so far, having money for your wants, having money for your must-haves. This is really the basis for creating a future that is very successful financially. From doing what we've done, you now know what you can spend on your wants, and having this knowledge, you're free to spend it any way you want, and you've worked it out with your partner. This can make life a lot easier, but it also means it is time to really face head-on what spending makes sense for your life, and you need a plan that helps you make conscious choices about your money with no more sweeping everything into these two confused categories of I gotta have it, or on the other side, I can't afford it. You really want to be in the driver's seat, and it's time now with all of this knowledge to decide once and for all what you really want. And next week we'll start looking at building your future by paying off your past. And the final tip for the week, if you are late or have missed mortgage payments, then after it is paid and you've caught up, make sure you have really caught up on the books of the bank. Banks use corporate accounts and suspense accounts to deal with late payments, late fees, and penalties. Ask the bank for a written statement detailing what you owe to the penny and the status of your account. You even have a right to ask for a payoff statement to make sure that you are really caught up. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and you have been listening to Life in Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083, or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous, debt manageable life.